Okay, so this is going to be fun. This is a sci-fi edition of Whose Century Is It? And why sci-fi? Well, I mean, sci-fi has helped us for generations. Think about the future. Think about what the future might be like. Imagine different futures. Imagine how we might live in them. Perhaps avoid the ones we don't want. And sci-fi fans have ranged from preteens to presidents. Ronald Reagan used to get his own sci-fi briefing. Barack Obama tucked into the dystopian Chinese sci-fi trilogy, The Three-Body Problem. If you think the future is dark, just wait until you read that. And in Silicon Valley?
I think a lot of people who are drawn to building new things are really fascinated by trying to think about the world differently, like trying to find new angles.
This is Elliot Pepper, an Oakland native in his early 30s who went from doing Silicon Valley venture capital work with startups to writing science fiction. 6 books in the past 4 years. And they've caught the eye of and kudos from sci-fi master William Gibson. He's the author of the 1984 novel Neuromancer and much more, and is known for saying, "The future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed." When Elliot spoke at Google, he asked the audience how many people had read William Gibson, and almost every hand shot up, which, he says, didn't really surprise him.
So I think a lot of folks who go into engineering, who go into the sciences, connect with science fiction a lot. And I think that it's a feedback loop in the sense that how we look at the world, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, absolutely changes the kinds of technologies we build and how they're deployed.
Elliot takes a thoughtful, informed approach to what he calls speculative fiction about the near-term future. He weaves in familiar themes: the perils of climate change, threats to privacy, the relatively unchecked power of internet and social media companies, and how nefarious actors can use them to manipulate people's emotions and actions and sense of reality. And then there are the challenges to nation-states that want to limit that power and the potential abuse of it. If you're thinking, all of that sounds like today's headlines, they are. But they weren't necessarily when Elliot was writing the plot lines that hone in on these issues and amp them up a couple of levels.
Honestly, I think that a lot of writing fiction is about paying attention. I went to a Socratic middle school, and I loved that because it was all about asking questions. It was more important for you to ask the right question than to give the right answer. And I really enjoyed that, and that's how I try to approach my writing, how to decide on what the right story is to tell.
And Elliot's been telling some pretty prescient stories. The week I'm doing this podcast, in late November 2018, California, where I live, is reeling from its most deadly forest fires in recorded history. A new U.S. climate assessment produced by 13 federal agencies warns that climate change is not only real and ongoing, but could slash 10% from U.S. GDP by the end of the century, twice the impact of the financial crisis a decade ago. Facebook has been getting a shellacking this month for its executives dissembling about how much they knew and when about Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections and the Brexit vote in the U.K., about the hate speech it allowed on its platform in Myanmar that helped spark genocide against the Rohingya Muslim minority, about how anti-Semitic accusations that George Soros was funding attacks against Facebook came from a right-wing consultancy group working with Facebook. All that stuff. That's all happening now. But Elliot's novel, Bandwidth, which was published in June, foretold much of this. Its sequel, Borderless, published in October, takes the story further. Elliot's now copy-editing the third book in what he calls the Analog Trilogy. Analog, that's in contrast, of course, to the constant digital feed in our lives.
So the first book was really about that question, how do feeds shape our lives? How do they shape our personal lives? And then how, in turn, does that shape our politics? It focused on the geopolitics of climate change. Borderless, book two, really focuses on this precise question. What do the rise of these new global tech platforms and issues and the decline of the nation state's ability to tackle many of those issues, where does that end up, right? Like, if you're pitting technology against the nation state, what happens? And book three is really about what comes next. It really addresses the question that I think is incredibly important, especially in an area like the San Francisco Bay Area, where people are very involved in the world of technology and not particularly involved in the world of politics and history and those aspects of human experience, is that our major tech companies here in the US have not come to terms with their own scale.
But in the near future, they may have to. Maybe sooner than they think. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad, a former China and East Asia correspondent, now director of audio journalism at UC Berkeley. That's the news, actually, since the last episode. And of course, it's a delight working with smart, aspiring journalists who love audio. I've also had fun learning my way into this new gig. But as you can imagine, it takes time and focus, and hence this podcast hiatus for the past few months. It's back now, and back to coming out monthly. If you've been a listener, thanks for coming back. If you're new to this, welcome. So, back to sci-fi and to Elliot Pepper's work. I went to meet Elliot at his home on a quiet residential street in Oakland, where a little library sits outside, one of those little wooden boxes on a pole from which anyone can take a book or leave a book. Inside the house is a friendly, furry pooch named Claire.
Yeah. Okay, Claire. Hey. Yeah, that's my puppy. Hey.
There's an eerie living room with big windows, wooden floors, and the desk where Elliot does his writing.
But I would never want to only do that. One of the weird things about writing novels, and I think this is probably very different than reporting, is that it's very solitary. I'm here with my dog, Claire, and it's me and the page. For a long time, right? Months and months and months when you're working on a book. And I'm a pretty social person. So I like meeting people, being inspired by other people, working with other people. I also like taking a step back and needing to put in the work to create something myself. But I've found that those reinforce each other.
As do Elliot's love of history and his MA in international affairs and management and the time he spent in Taiwan learning Chinese affect the way he thinks about the future. The title of his most recent book, Borderless, reflects not just a world he can imagine coming, indeed, that may already in part be here, but what people within his own family have experienced in the past.
My oma and opa on my father's side, who are both Dutch. My paternal grandfather was Jewish. My paternal grandmother was Protestant. They were born around sort of like early 1910s, basically. So they lived through both world wars. And they were living in Amsterdam, and when they got married, my grandmother's family disowned her because I don't know how well known this is outside of Holland, but prior to World War II and even during World War II, a lot of Dutch people were already like Nazi collaborators. I mean, anti-Semitism was not something confined to Germany. It was very much throughout Europe. And so my grandmother's family was like, the hell are you doing marrying a Jew? It's the late 30s. It was clear war was coming as well. So they were like, we both don't support this and it's a bad idea. And they did it anyway. And my grandfather was a diamond cutter. And when the Nazis invaded, he built a cupboard like above a wardrobe in their house. And their neighbor was a wallpaper man. He helped them make it seamless with the rest of the apartments. It looked like it was just like built into the wall rather than being a separate compartment. And so whenever the Nazis would raid their neighborhood and search every apartment, he would hide in there and try not to sneeze, basically, as they were searching the house. And my grandfather was one of the only surviving members of his whole family. Everyone else was killed in the camps. My grandmother, even though she was Protestant, so she would be okay, right, as long as they didn't find her husband. And even though she had infants to like raise and protect in the middle of wartime Europe, joined the Dutch resistance. So she ferried information, supplies, and people in and out of the camps and, you know, risked her life every day to do this. And after the war ended, she ended up getting like a medal from the Queen, and she was awarded the sort of highest state honor of the State of Israel that they provide to non-Jews who tried to protect Jews during the war.
Elliot says in the novel Borderless, the protagonist, a refugee-turned-secret agent named Diana, was inspired by his grandmother, and the title is in some ways a reflection of his grandparents' experience.
they had to cross so many borders in their lives, not even just political ones, but religious ones, personal ones, risking your life every day for strangers when it would be totally understandable for you to do nothing but try to protect your children. And then eventually political ones as well. They moved to this new country, they'd learn a whole new language, build a new life here. After the war, they were terrified because they thought that the Cold War was going to break out into World War III in Europe, which was very reasonable. I mean, they had already lived through World War I and II, right? So they were like, this is going bad fast. And that's when they emigrated to the United States. So yeah, they just like showed up in New York, had no money. And my grandfather ended up, because he was a diamond cutter, he ended up getting a job cutting the lenses, like the glass lenses for NASA to photograph the dark side of the moon for the first time, which was really neat. For me, it's been really a beautiful thing to then learn more about what they went through and what their experiences say about the world we're building and the country we're building today.
In the world Elliot built in the Analog series, wildfires have laid waste to much of Southern California. The polar ice caps have melted. Everyone is immersed in their digital feeds, so much that when people visit a discreet bar called Analog, where there is no digital signal, it takes a disorienting moment or two to adjust. Controlling this feed is a huge company called Commonwealth. Think Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Uber combined, times 10. Kind of like the digital world China is building in real life, with its social credit system that, with the help of apps like WeChat and Alipay, collects and centralizes all kinds of personal digital data. Where you've been and with whom, what you've said, what you've bought, what sites you've visited online, if you say or do something the party doesn't like, or if you're financially or criminally irresponsible, your social credit rating goes down. You might actually find it hard to buy a train ticket, or a house, or find a job. If you're a political activist, or a member of an ethnic minority the government suspects of harboring separatist notions, like the Uyghurs, who are Turkic Muslims, or Tibetans, or even Hong Kong Chinese, speaking out could wreck your life, maybe even get you thrown into an internment camp, as has happened to what human rights groups say is up to 1 million Uyghurs. Your social credit rating can even go down if friends or family behave badly, from the government's point of view. The company Commonwealth, in Eliot's novels, is different. Commonwealth is privately held, but its power is considerable, as are the problems it can cause. Read Bandwidth and Borderless to find out how. But for now, listen in to the rest of my conversation with Elliot. He says it's interesting to him how Silicon Valley's most powerful companies are struggling to react appropriately to their users' discontent and to avoid destructive, unintended consequences.
You can understand it, right? Like if you started a company and you got by being scrappy and creative and having to do a ton of experiments and failing all the time and then trying to fix stuff, naturally, someone who excels at that and develops that as a skill, that changes how they look at the world, right? They see the positive results from living in that way. But the problem is, if you become really successful, suddenly, every decision you make, including inaction, impacts millions, if not billions, of people's lives. And that requires a different level of responsibility than when you're screwing around and trying to like experiment and build something new that no one's using. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is famous for wanting to keep as much power within Facebook's corporate hierarchy as possible. Why does he want to do that? Well, imagine if you started a company and it became really successful and people loved it, but everybody wants a piece of it. Everybody wants to tell you what to do. You look at your colleagues who run other companies and their boards are ordering them to do stupid things because it will maximize quarterly profit. And you're like, I don't want my baby to go that route. So instead, I'm going to structure everything I do to make sure I retain all the voting control. I can make the decisions. So he's king, right? He has created an empire where he is a monarch. As these technologies become infrastructure in the same way that plumbing is infrastructure, that roads are infrastructure, that electrical grids are infrastructure that we take for granted, those companies are the more successful they are at becoming utilities, the more important it becomes that we start to think about them like utilities that should be regulated or should have different governance structures than a private firm with a monarch. And book three is about a tech platform being forced to reckon with its scale and the responsibility that comes with it.
Well, and it's interesting, you just used the word platform. A lot of the companies we're talking about in real life, they're like, you know, no, we're not a media company. No, we're not a utility. You know, like, let us play dodgeball here with right. what we actually are. So it's not just about scale. It's also about the nature of the company and its impact, how it impacts people's lives.
Absolutely. And I think that this also highlights some of the other. So a lot of the semantic dodgeball that these companies are playing, they're playing because of our legal system. For example, you know, in the US, we have different laws that govern media companies. Like if you own a newspaper, you have a certain responsibility for what's printed in it, right? Because you have editorial oversight. Well, does that apply if you are Facebook, where there is no editorial oversight, and yet people are posting on your platform and anyone else can read it? Those are questions that weren't questions when we wrote the laws we have. And so I think that a lot of the semantic dodgeball that these companies are playing are because lawyers are saying, like, you can't say this, you should say this, because those laws have to be updated. Google and Facebook have annual revenues that dwarf many countries' GDPs. They're not countries, but what are they? They're suddenly now these geopolitical players that operate on a different axis. And I found that really fascinating because there is this obvious source of tension. And then you also have obvious blowback where you have sort of the rise of this new nationalism that's happening in the world right now, where I think a lot of people are afraid because they see these traditional structures of power crumbling away in certain areas, and they react by trying to strengthen them, by trying to build a wall. And I think that's going to be, in many ways, the story of the next century. We have these global issues that we have to tackle as a species, and yet the political systems we've created for ourselves aren't very well suited yet to tackling those problems because they're still in that those little colored lines that you see on the globe as a kid.
So then what do you make in the real world in this moment as you look at what the Trump administration has been doing in terms of trying to get out of trade deals, close the borders, turn inward, say, no, we can be who we want to be, and we want to be a nation of white people, and we don't want to have to give up anything or compromise with other countries in trade deals or on the environment or whatever if it's not in our interests?
When do people fight like that? When do people make reactionary decisions like that? It's when they internally feel like they're in a corner and they're fighting for their life. They're scared. In many ways, that fear is understandable. We live in a world that is changing fast, and change can be very uncomfortable. And so the fact that people are reacting to that fear in ugly ways, I think that's going to keep happening.
And yet a reader could come away from your writing thinking, you're kind of an optimist about the future.
I'm absolutely an optimist about the future. It's funny, actually. Sometimes reviewers will describe my books as dystopian, and I'm like, what? Come on, they're not dystopian, right? Like, I work really hard to actually try to make sure that they are complex, that they're nuanced, that they aren't clearly black or white. But the thing that I always come back to is, no matter how upsetting and disorienting and scary the world feels, everyone I know is trying to do their best. I mean, honestly, everyone I know is trying to do their best. And I think that it is really easy to assign bad motivations or evil motivations to people who you don't know. You don't see what's going on in their lives. You don't see where they're coming from or what other factors might be influencing a decision that you read as evil, right? Or that you read as just bad. And this doesn't even have to go all the way up to the scale of like national politics. I think it can be a really useful skill when you receive an email that feels thoughtless from a colleague, say, or from a friend, to assume first that they were having a bad day. And only if you do a lot of due diligence and discover that they are actually trying to be malicious to ever believe they're malicious. And that's what I try to channel in the books. Even when I'm writing about the antagonist, the people doing the worst things, I really try to think about why it would make sense in their own mind to do that.
So I wanted to get back to some of the tensions in the books. One of them is the globalized world versus sort of reflexive defense of nationalism. Mm-hmm. One of your characters, Javier Flores, says, you know, open your eyes, nation states are dying. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true?
I mean, I think that like the idea of the nation state that we've been working with in the 20th century is dying, yes. I absolutely think that. I mean, like okay, you spent a lot of time in China. China has been China for thousands of years, even though the government of China has changed many times through dynastic succession, through different structures of government, and all of these different things. So China is still going to be China. But how we've structured our governments, the shared rules that we have all agreed to, the social contract that defines how countries operate, I think that is already shifting dramatically. And I think it will shift that much more in the coming decades.
So in China, obviously, right now, the government is placing a very large bet on the idea that the age of the nation state is not only not over, but that the Chinese government within the nation state can protect its borders from external threats and can protect itself from internal threats through the social credit system.
Yeah.
Given all that you focused on in both Bandwidth and Borderless in terms of surveillance, in terms of manipulation, in terms of the role that technology can play to basically control people's experience of being alive, how do you read what's happening in China right now?
I mean, I find the social credit system terrifying, like personally, right? Like absolutely terrifying. I guess like some of the odd things that when I read about the social credit system or systems like it is like how much we are already living under similar conditions in the US in the sense that like our credit scores are like employers are looking at every Facebook post they can find. So the difference with China's social credit system compared to like how people already vet people's behavior in the US today is that in the US we actually have freedom of speech. The other thing in the US is that right now your Facebook data is different than your Google data, which is different than your medical records, which right? So it's we have these like silos of information about you. Unless it's the NSA and they're cheating, theoretically, people aren't supposed to be able to have access to all of them. Although data transaction, like clearinghouses, do some incredibly sketchy stuff already in the US that basically allows you to blend many of those data sets together so someone can get a pretty clear picture of digital breadcrumbs your behavior has left on the internet. The other thing that I would say about China is that they are investing far more than the US government, at least, in actually developing new technologies on the internet, like machine learning technologies, so like specialized artificial intelligence. Many technologists today see machine learning and specialized artificial intelligence as the basis for the next Google, the next Facebook, the next big tools that we can use to build a future. I think that China is being very forward-looking in how they are trying to set themselves up for the next century and set themselves up for what happens after traditional nation states' borders become more and more permeable.
So spin that out, because I mean, when I'm looking at the way the Chinese government is trying to manage how research and development is done, Made in China 2025 wants to make a lot of this new technology, you know, whatever the breakthroughs are that happen in China, proprietary. I mean, they'd like to sort of build a walled garden around them. It's like, you know, we want this and we don't want you to have this. And I mostly agree with what you said, that China is looking forward in the century and thinking of basically how to move technology forward. It's sort of implicit in that it suggests, and maybe I'm reading into it, is, and that will, you know, help to change and shape the world, possibly for the better, because there will be these new technologies out there.
So data is the new oil, right? That's like one of the lovely slogans that you'll see repeated on every tech site everywhere. But for very real reasons, when you are trying to build cutting edge software today, software that uses the most advanced techniques in this space, you need data to train your algorithms on. So if you don't have an enormous, absolutely astounding amount of data, you just can't make software as good as other people. Right now in the US, for very good reasons that I support, we have limitations on what you're able to do with data. So in the US, Netflix knows what you're watching. Facebook knows what you're liking and what you're sharing and who your friends are. Google knows what you're searching for and how you send email. Those are sort of these big silos. But in China, if we want to talk about the feed, the amount of data available for the feed to use in China is much more than in the US already right now.
And much more concentrated.
Right. So here's the weird part, though. There are many horrible ways in which this is already being used to repress dissent, to catch people who disagree with the government. And at the same time, because the more data you have, the better algorithms you can train, there is a tendency towards monopolization. Just the incentives that this technology sets up mean that if Google did buy Facebook and did buy Amazon, you know, like if you had all of these tech companies put together, it would be scary because they'd know everything, but they'd also be able to make some really useful, convenient stuff. So when I say that the Chinese government is setting themselves up for success with this specific technology, it's not because I think they'll use it benevolently. I also don't think they are exclusively going to use it malevolently, right? Like there are many different factions in China wanting to do different things for different reasons. And so I think they're going to use it in many different ways. But again, just like the internet is used in many different ways, the US has been the leader in the, I mean, we built the internet basically. So that has given us a huge step up economically and politically in the world over the last few decades. When I look at the world today and when I look at the incentive structures that artificial intelligence technology and machine learning is setting up, China is being very thoughtful about a long-term strategy in the way that the US isn't.
I'm going to jump in here for a second because this was a long and winding and fascinating conversation, though I can't say I was persuaded along the way that I want one giant social media company to have all my private data, much less one that shares that data with the government, as happens in China. But Elliot and I did eventually get to talking about the writing of science fiction itself and how he notices that certain tropes keep coming up.
In science fiction, you know, writing science fiction, it's funny, like looking at a lot of the movies and books that are out there that portray, say, artificial intelligence. The classic thing is the Terminator, robot that takes over the world and kills everyone. Or even something like that movie Her, where it's robot turns into a human that someone falls in love with, basically. To me, they really miss what's important about these new technologies, which is how they impact power in our society. I'm much less worried about Terminator. I mean, there is literally zero evidence that we have created, for all the artificial intelligence we've created, that we have created any form or even moved one nanometer towards consciousness. Those are completely not plausible from anything that's actually happening in computer science. However, what we have created is non-human intelligence that is extremely useful precisely because it is inhuman. Can you imagine having a concierge who was as good at being Google Maps on the phone for you as Google Maps is at being Google Maps? No. Software is useful because it thinks differently than human brains. And that, paired with the fact that the more data you have, the better software you can make, means that we have this dangerous tendency towards centralization of power. Whether that power is held by a state-owned entity or a private entity or an individual or what have you. We have these new systems that are really changing the structure of power in society, and right now we don't have a Bill of Rights for that.
It's interesting to think that we could have a Bill of Rights for how tech and social media companies can and can't manipulate or mislead us or sell and profit from our data without our explicit consent and without at least sharing those profits with us. Hard to imagine Facebook and Google agreeing to such a thing, but stranger things have happened that people didn't see coming. Or maybe some speculative fiction saw it coming. So I asked,
did you read a lot of speculative fiction when you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I read a lot. I read really widely. So I love reading speculative fiction, but I read a ton of history. I read a ton of, you know, sociology. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read a lot of literary fiction. I just love reading, basically. So, you know, I'll read a book and it'll turn me on to another book, right? Maybe I'll research the author and find out what inspired them and then read that. This actually happened recently with William Gibson. We were going back and forth on email and he recommended reading Borges, who I'd never read before. Jorge Luis Borges was an Argentinian writer in the middle of the 20th century, and he never wrote any novels, but he wrote a number of collections of short stories, as well as essays and cultural criticism and stuff like that. He has one collection of short stories called Ficciones that was written in the late 30s and early 40s and is widely credited with prefiguring basically every core problem that the internet has presented to society. So it is amazing. If you haven't read those stories, like, it changed what I thought short stories could be. I didn't even read many short stories before reading him. And now I read a lot of short stories. And that specific collection, Ficciones, is just mind-boggling. And he's probably the single most influential writer I'm aware of on writers of speculative fiction. So most readers, like if you talk to like people who read a lot of science fiction, for example, they may not have ever heard of Borges. I mean, some have, but some haven't. But if you talk to people who write science fiction and speculative fiction, he is a huge influence. And I think that's also largely true for a lot of computer scientists.
So you read a lot of different kinds of books when you were young, but including science fiction, speculative fiction. When you think about the books you read then and what the futures ended up being, how much in general was on the mark as opposed to, well, that was certainly what the future looked like back then, but this is why we kind of veered in a different direction?
So I think there's some really funny examples of what science fiction has got wrong. So like cell phones, very few science fiction books from before cell phones actually have cell phones, and certainly don't have them in the way that they are totally ubiquitous and sort of the base level of computing for humans today. So that's a funny one. Less funny is climate change. Now, speculative fiction, and Bandwidth included, wrestles with climate change and its impacts, its social impacts, its environmental impacts. For a very long time, science fiction didn't ever prefigure climate change at all. So a lot of older science fiction, it's not a part of the futures that were imagined then. At least for me, many of the things that are most interesting in the sense that they got right are actually on the social side of things. So we've been talking about William Gibson. Like, if you want to think about like the most realistic aspects of Neuromancer, which is the book he's most famous for, I'd say that one of the most realistic parts of that book is actually these vastly powerful tech firms that have really successfully evaded any kind of oversight. Like, I feel like that aspect of that book has become very realistic, even though if you read that book today, a lot of the gadgets feel dated. If you look at the history of science fiction as a genre, back in like the 50s and 60s, people would say there was a split between what they called hard and soft science fiction. Hard science fiction, meaning that the authors took the science very seriously, right? So they really tried to make their spaceships work in a way that was plausible, for example. And you would often be able to tell this because if you were reading the book, you'd have long sections that were basically about how the spaceship worked rather than about what the characters were doing. And then on the other side, you had authors who were writing quote unquote soft science fiction, where the emphasis was not on how plausible the technology was, but was more about the characters or more about the social impacts of how this world is different, right? Or how the rules are changing in this world. And if you asked anyone at the time, almost anyone, regardless of which they preferred, would have agreed that the hard science fiction was more realistic, that the futures extrapolated were more likely to happen. And the result has been the opposite, that when you look back, the books that were considered soft science fiction, like Philip K. Dick, a lot of his books, even Ursula Le Guin, right? Like, you look at these books that were never, the author was not trying to make them technically plausible. And yet the social issues that they unearthed have proved to be far more timeless and far more accurate to today's world than the folks who were trying for, you know, getting the gizmos right.
So you've said, I think you've written, that you're really glad you're living in the present moment and there's no other time in history when you would have preferred to have been alive. Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll still feel that way, you know, 20, 30 years from now in the future you're imagining now in your books?
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that the protagonists of my books would never trade their future for our present. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll find out, right? I mean, I don't know. Like, the only thing I can speak to is the present and then what I've read of the past, right? Nobody knows the future. And everything I read about the past, and I love reading history, every single thing I read convinces me more and more that I'm so glad I don't live in the past. You know, we have antibiotics, we have plumbing, I can take a shower. Our lifestyles today, even if you are really poor, many of the things that you have access to, a Roman prince would never have been able to have access to. That doesn't mean we don't have tons of huge problems. We absolutely do. We have poverty is an enormous global issue, climate change, racism. It's just that we also, if you decide to have a child, it is much less likely that you and the child are going to die in childbirth. And that's amazing. Like, that's we have contraception. It blows my mind. So that's where we are today. And my perspective is that if most people are doing their best, and that's where we are today, then I'm excited for the future.
Elliot Pepper, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks to you for listening. That sci-fi music you heard at the beginning of the piece is from ALXD Music, which you can find on soundcloud.com. If you want to catch up on past Whose Century Is It episodes, you can find the whole archive at whosecenturyisit.com, and most of it, with photos and print versions of the episodes, at pri.org/century. Whose Century Is It started as a co-production with PRI's The World, and is now all mine. If you've got comments, criticisms, ideas for future episodes, send them along to whosecentury@gmail.com, or send a note to the Whose Century Is It Facebook page, or send a message to me on Twitter at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. The next episode is with writer and science journalist Charles Mann, and is about one of the most important questions of our time. Can we as a human race innovate our way out of the mess we've created with the environment and climate change, or will we trigger our own extinction? That's the subject of his most recent book, The Wizard and the Prophet. Come on back and listen in.